Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Well, I kind of feel like a mad scientist. What is it that Thomas Edison said about the light bulb before he made it happen? I haven't failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that don't work. Hi, it's Fisher here, your congenial root sleuth, and this is Extreme Genes Family History Radio, America's family history show, where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Well, a few weeks ago, you may remember we talked on the show and on our Facebook page about a haul of 1850s era daguerreotypes on my name line in New York that I was the recipient of. Well, several have real problems with tarnish, and we talked about taking a crack at electrolysis to clear it up. Yes, it's a technique that really works, but it's also quite risky. These pictures are actually made on silver plates, and I'll tell you about what happened with this in just a couple of moments. Our guests this week include, coming up in about 7 minutes, David Allen Lambert of the New England Historic Genealogical Society, who will talk to us about colonial wars, those conflicts that took place over the century and a half that led up to the Revolution. Many of us, maybe even you, have ancestors who fought in one or more of those wars. David will go through a list of them. There were more than you think, and tell you what records can be found on your ancestors' involvement in these very bloody conflicts. Then, later in the show, I'll introduce you to a North Carolina lady named Joy Shiver, who's going to help you find original documents relating to your ancestors. Things like letters written by your great-great-grandfather, family Bibles, muster rolls. You can own them. It's a great idea. She's turned into a little business that will cost you very little money. I know you're going to love her idea. And then Tom Perry, our Preservation Authority, returns with ideas on getting better audio and preserving it. It's great advice on a medium that's often very difficult to manage. Okay, back to the electrolysis experiment on the daguerreotype photos. Ron Fox, who's a regular on the show and an antique photo expert, got together with me a few days ago, and we decided to give it a shot. We collected a D battery, a strip of silver, some alligator clips, a plastic bin, along with some distilled water and ammonia. The negative clip was attached to the silver-plated daguerreotype with the positive attached to the strip of silver. Then the picture was put into the solution, 1:3 ammonia to distilled water, as was the silver strip with the alligator clip. And we didn't let the two pieces touch. It would have damaged the photo. The first picture I tried was a pretty corroded image of my great-great-uncle George Cooper Fisher. He was probably about 25 at the time, in the early 1850s. As the electricity began to work, you could watch as the corrosion would bubble and was drawn to the piece of silver. The edge of the silver eventually turned black, and we would periodically pull it out and clean the edge off. Whichever edge of the picture was closest to the silver strip would get the most response. So we would turn it periodically. But we also noticed that it would pull the tarnish across the picture from the far edge. After a short time on each edge, we also noticed that while the picture was looking pretty good, it was beginning to look worse. So we stopped and washed the image with distilled water and used a blow dryer on the back of the picture to dry it off. The corrosion that had covered George's head and nose for who knows how long was gone, and you could actually see a whole lot more of him. We could see his hair for the first time. It was amazing. I couldn't have been more pleased. Then we tried one of the four daguerreotypes of George's brother, Robert. This went well, too, until I got a little greedy. We figured that the rest of the tarnish from the edges would just get better and better. Wanting to protect the face in particular, I left the top part out of the solution and only worked the bottom half. But that soon developed a dark look that just kept getting worse. Finally, I gave up, with that picture noticeably worse than how it started and a whole lot worse than where it had been 2 minutes into the process. So we were one for two. Fortunately, I made a scan of each before I started the whole thing, and it's still possible that down the line I can take another crack at poor Uncle Robert. It might still be salvageable. The befores and afters can be seen on our website, extremegenes.com. If you have any thoughts about trying this to clean an old daguerreotype photo, remember, it's not easy, it's risky, And there's more than one way to do it. Our family histoire news for this week comes from Brazil. That's where Jose Santos has been getting a lot of attention for celebrating his 126th birthday. He is said to have been born on July 7th, 1888, just 2 months after Brazil put an end to slavery. Jose never married, has no children, walks just fine, eats four meals a day. And despite smoking a pack of cigarettes a day for 50 years, yes, he started in his 70s, he has no health problems. His doctor says his cholesterol's good, his blood pressure's good, and he doesn't have diabetes. He does take vitamins. He enjoys singing, though no one knows the songs because they come from a time no one on the planet remembers. He hates bathing and refuses to shower. The management at the old folks' home he's living in says they're doing all they can to further document Jose's age to prove once and for all that the oldest person on the planet lives in their facility. And coming up next, David Allen Lambert of the New England Historic Genealogical Society joins us to talk about colonial wars. Yes, there were a bunch of them before the Revolution. What were they about, and how can you find records of your ancestors' participation in them? David tells us next in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here with my guest from the New England Historic Genealogical Society, David Allen Lambert. David, welcome back to the show.
Very nice to be here, sir.
And, you know, at this time of year, we think a lot about the Revolutionary War, and we've talked and done some segments on that, and we were kicking around the idea, you know, there were wars before the Revolution. And, absolutely. And I think a lot of people kind of forget that colonial period was a good 150 years before we got to the Revolution. And we had to have some ancestors who were fighting in some of those wars. And I thought you being the man when it comes to military stuff at the New England Historic Genealogical Society, we might kick around what some of those wars were, what some of the records are, and how we can find those. So where do we start?
Well, I mean, we're having conflicts with the Native American population, with our ancestors, you know, brushing up against their territory as early as the Jamestown conflicts of the 1620s, where the conflicts back then, you have in the Powhatan Indians going against, killing about 347 settlers, but then turning around, the English retaliated and basically did a genocide for the next 10 years. So this is the kickoff, right as soon as settlement comes in. And the same thing is true in New England. We have the Pequot War down in Connecticut in the 1630s, and where the attack at the stockade fort there at Mystic basically, you know, annihilated many, many Pequot Indians. And then 40 years later, you got the settlers in Massachusetts and Rhode Island that are on land of the Wampanoag Indians, and Metacomet, or King Philip, as we call him. There's that whole war in the 1670s that basically pulls in a lot of the New Englanders to defend their homes and whatnot. There have been countless raids, and then that just goes right into the 18th century wars with the French. And, you know, obviously, I think it's an ironic twist that after the wars we have with France, they come to our aid when we're fighting Britain.
Isn't that strange how that all works? You know, today's enemy is tomorrow's friend.
Exactly.
You know, and you look back to the big one, I think, that most people have not heard about, but don't realize the impact of it, was the King Philip War. I mean, that wiped out huge chunks of the population of both the natives and the settlers. And right. And how many people were involved in that? I mean, I know of at least two of my ancestors who were either killed or wounded in that particular war. And there are records of these people out there. Let's talk about how to find some of those. Let's go back to the very beginning and say, okay, the Pequot War. Where would you find records of ancestors then? That was in the 1630s, right?
Exactly. In the Pequot War, you have the listing of all of the Connecticut soldiers that were involved in the Massachusetts. These are already in print, and that's very true of the 17th century. And any HGS and any of these 17th century or early 18th century wars, we generally have a published tome. I mean, because you're dealing with non-military records, like you're not going to get a docket of information, like with, you know, a physical description of your ancestor. You're going to get John Smith marched 14 days, served with Captain Trumbull's company, Colonel Lambert's regiment, and where they may have marched to. So what you have to do with these type of records, and like I say, NEHCS, we have them both online, as well as having, especially for the French and Indian War period, we have the published sources, so people can turn to them and see, oh, okay, this is the source where the actual record came from, and then go back into the manuscripts, may it be at the State Archives of Massachusetts or Connecticut or whatever the state might be, and find the original muster roll, so they can be 100% certain that the record is exact. The problem is the detail's not there.
Right, right, right. Now, did any of these guys ever sign these things?
You usually get the quartermaster will sign off. Sometimes the mustering sergeant will often sign the muster roll, you know, proving that these people are on the roll call. If it's a letter, say I had a regiment of men and they expended needs of coats or shoes or whatever the case might be, I might send a letter to the head of the army or to, in this case, the colony that I'm from, is saying that my men are in dire need and there's a signature of me writing this letter. That's usually where you get the signatures. Where they signed up on the actual muster roll, or you know, per se on the roll call, if you will, not many of those survive. We usually have the muster rolls after the fact, so we know they served for X amount of time. And it's almost like you compare it now to, say, an Excel spreadsheet, where there's a name, then there's a column tallied with how many days marched, or you know, if there's some also notes. So if the person died, if they lost their gun, or they lost their coat or something that was supplied to them, there's often fees against that where they'll say, well, you're going to be paid £3 for your service, but you lost your gun, so we're minusing whatever the cost that is and pass the showing. Yeah. So,
and a lot of them were kind of impressed into service for this thing to begin with, weren't they?
Pretty much. Well, I mean, I think that in the case of the colonial period, I mean, they're in fear for their lives. I mean, I'm not saying that what we did to the native population, I'm a tribal historian. I mean, I'm not anywhere proud of what my ancestors did against the native population, but also they were trying to protect their families. So here they are settling a new place, and all of a sudden they're being retaliated. Their houses are being burned and whatnot. So you do have this whole idea of it's either fight or perish.
Yes.
And I think that there were thousands of people that died at the time of the King Philip's War, and it was overestimated 100,000 pounds of loss for, you know, property and homes and crops and animals, et cetera. I mean, that's the numbers that they come up with.
Yeah, I have seen, I think Nathaniel Philbrick mentioned that in his book Mayflower, that the economy of the region didn't recover from King Philip's War for 100 years.
And, oh, I would truly say that, yeah.
And when you put that forward 100 years, now you're talking the Revolution, and now you've got another problem.
We didn't come out on top of that for a little while. I mean, the whole Continental Congress and all that, and the nation was pretty much in debt starting off. I mean, that's why they were giving land away versus big cash bonuses for your service.
And mortality, as far as it went with the King Philip's War, was greater than that of the Civil War.
Especially if you look at the native population, because we'll never truly know how many natives perished
right
during the swamp fights, et cetera. I mean, because there was obviously no muster rolls for them. We have the oral tradition and whatnot. And, of course, the whole family of Massasoit, I mean, any of the descendants were basically hunted down. I mean, and there are families that have come forward that are of some descent through a brother Alexander, and there are other families that have made claim. But it's a hard case to prove. I had a lot of people say that they related to King Philip. Well, the problem with that is that we know of his family was sold into slavery into Barbados, and I mean, he was executed and his head stuck on a pike in Plymouth, Massachusetts for a number of years, and it just sat there as a warning to all other people that we're going to infringe upon the Plymouth colony or Mass Bay colony for that matter.
Well, let's talk about some more about these colonial war records.
Sure, of course. Well, I mean, we have a website, AmericanAncestors.org, which is the website for the New England Historic Genealogical Society. And on AmericanAncestors.org, under our databases, what we have done is we have digitized records that were at the Massachusetts State Archives, for instance, and this has French and Indian War, which we covered the 1740s to the 1760s, Queen Anne's War, King William's War, any of the 17th century battles, and in fact, these are just searchable by name, so you can put in a last name and see if you have any collateral ancestors.
What area does this cover, David?
This one in particular is under this under Massachusetts, but I was going to add for other states, if we don't have the book resources here at NEHS, we also have the New England Historical and Genealogical Register that has the publication of countless articles, diaries, account books, letters written from people during these wars. The diaries are an amazing collection that we have where a person might give the exact detailed account of where the regiment was, where they marched off to. So we added a little bit more color than just a name and a date and a regiment. And that's what you have to actually hope for. And what I tell people to do in their research when they're doing this, don't just look at your ancestor. Adopt the company that he was in. Find out the stories of all of those people. Did they have diaries? Did they keep account books?
Yes.
Did they get land claims? That's the sort of thing that way you can kind of understand where they all were. And if you find a record of your ancestor, don't forget to look into the people he was serving with, because they may have the details and the clues that may tell more about what your ancestor's situation was, where they were fighting, etc.
Well, and that's great advice for pretty much any war, as far as
exactly.
That goes. I know the Revolution, it was the same thing. I was able to trace one of the people who fought alongside one of my ancestors, and I was able then to transpose my guy on top of that and said, okay, well, this fellow said we signed up at this date and place, and then we were assigned to do this, so I knew my guy did that.
And then in the later wars, you get the affidavits from people, like especially with the Civil War, where there's, and then also the Revolutionary War, that I served with so-and-so at this battle, or
yes.
I know that he was injured and was in the camp hospital, So the military records really add color and dimension to a life that may just be a name and a date on your chart. And I always say, if you have somebody who is male that you think was able-bodied and they fit into the context of a particular battle, maybe the 17th century right on down through World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, as you're looking at the stories of your family in a larger sense of all the families, if you're doing a one-name study, try to find the military records if you can, because it really does enrich the sketch and the story of the person. And incidentally, on the King Philip's War, later this year, we're going to be reprinting Reverend George M. Bodge's book on the King Philip's War. It's a very thick tome that lists every soldier involved, and I am honored to have written the new preface to it. Where this is a very, very valuable book that will be available very shortly from NEHDS.
Wow, that's exciting stuff. Well, David Allen Lambert, great to have you back on the show. Thank you for some great advice on Colonial War research. I think a lot of people, first of all, just have to familiarize themselves with what those wars were and then try to figure out who was around at what point in time and might have been a part of that. And I would think the simplest thing might be to just start with county histories, yes?
Exactly. I mean, you can look at county and town histories. Town histories are great. They usually have a military records chapter listing the people that served. And a lot of communities around the country, especially in New England, you go to these towns and they usually have a memorial plaque, those people who may have served or, in a county or a town history. Local historical societies, as well as places like NEHDS here in Boston, Massachusetts, we can help you with that research and muster up the resources for you as well, no pun intended, to help you find your ancestry in their military records.
He's David Allen Lambert from the New England Historic Genealogical Society. Thanks so much, David.
My pleasure. Hope to be back on again when you need me.
And coming up next, imagine a site that can help you find that family Bible you've been looking for, or a letter from your great-great-grandfather. It has been developed. We'll talk to the developer coming up in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And, one of the things I like to discover are new ideas for helping us get together with information that we need to get closer to our ancestors, to learn more about them. And I found a site like that just this past week. It's called justajoy.com. And we have its owner and developer, Joy Shiver, on the phone right now from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Joy. Welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
It is great to have you on. And I was very excited about this because I think, and forgive me if I do this wrong and you can fix it a little bit, if I describe it in a way that people might understand. It reminds me of an eBay for family history items. I know it's not. There are major differences, but it's something similar to this, whereas people can sign up as members on your website, and then you can try to match up surnames of various items from, say, antique stores or other genealogists that people can pick up for their own family collection. Is that a good representation?
Yes, you did very well. We are. We would remind you of eBay because the antique dealers post the items. The way that we are specifically different is that we have a special surname field when items are posted. So even if your surname is something like Land or Green or House or one of those common words, you're still going to get the correct search results when you search on Just a Joy. And the results that you get will be specific items associated with that specific surname.
Now, you've been doing this for about 3 years, I understand.
We introduced Just a Joy 3 years ago, but we'd actually worked on it for many years before that.
Oh, I'm sure you have. You've thought this through. It's really impressive. And I was seeing some of the success stories there, and I'm going to let you tell one or two of those.
Well, we've had some exciting ones, and it seems like we regularly have ones that bring tears to your eyes. We matched a Civil War letter in California. We've matched many things. But one of the things that I thought was most dramatic was a lady in her 60s recovered a yearbook from the website, and you wouldn't think that a yearbook could be a tearjerker. But the lady had been adopted, and she had a great deal of trouble learning about her genetic family. So when she got her yearbook, and I was fortunate to be in her presence when this happened, she finally looked up from it with tears in her eyes and told me it was only the second time in her life that she had seen a picture of her biological father. So that was a dramatic moment.
Wow. And I saw one of them there where somebody mentioned they'd been a member for like 3 days or something and then found a Civil War letter written by a great-great-grandfather. I may be combining some stories here, but it was just enormously impressive.
Right. And, you know, that's the kind of matches that we hope for. There's thousands and thousands of things on the antique market that just change hands between collectors and dealers. And it just always seems so sad that there was no efficient way for the collectors and dealers to communicate with family members that the items were available.
Now, how does this work? If I wanted to join justajoy.com, I would sign up for, what is it, $20 a year? I mean, we're talking like just a few cents a day, 6 cents a day.
Yes, we want to keep the price low because we want people to stay with us. This is not like information. This is quite a bit harder, and it may take us more than a year to actually discover something that would be of great value to you and your descendants. So we want to keep the price low so you will just automatically re-up when the time comes and give us another year to get out there and keep digging.
Right. Well, you come up with, what, at least 100 new items a month relating to families.
That's right. And every item is associated with at least one surname. Some items, of course, may be associated with many more, such as a Civil War document from this, a muster roll, for instance, of a specific regiment may list as many as 100 soldiers that were on duty at the time in the Civil War.
Boy, isn't that something. Now, you mentioned to me off air earlier that sometimes you run across Revolutionary War items with the signatures of the soldiers on them.
Yes, we have quite a few members. All members can post, let me mention that, but you don't have to be an antique dealer. You can be a genealogist. But we have quite a few members who specialize in Revolutionary War pay documents or muster rolls. We even have things that are specific to the Minutemen that were Lexington and Concord. They were posted by a very wonderful dealer who specializes in those kind of things, and he is well known in the document world for having really nice things. So we were really fortunate that he took an interest in our project.
Now, what about family Bibles? I see you've had a few of them up there. Have you had much luck in matching them with people?
We were fortunate last year to match three, and all of them were wonderful stories. One in particular, a lady in Atlanta posted the Bible. She found it in a closet in her church. And the emails are generated every night at midnight based on the items that are posted in the past 24 hours. So an email went out to a lady who was a member in Virginia, and in Virginia Beach, and within 24 hours, the Bible had found its rightful place, and the lady got her Bible back. It was wonderful.
Now, what era was the Bible from?
That particular one was from 1810.
Wow. We're talking very early.
Right. And you can see a couple of stories about that story on our website. NPR did a story about it, and also the local Virginia Beach TV station did a story on that Bible.
If you're an antique dealer, I'm sure there are people who deal in that, or perhaps you're just somebody who's collected a bunch of items. For instance, not long ago, I was going through an old family Bible, not the one I just picked up a month or so ago, but one we've had in our family for some time, and found in its pages there was a little notice they hand out at a funeral from 1946, somebody had been born in 1870, somebody that had nothing to do with my family or my wife's family. And it's like, what do you do with something like this? I certainly don't want to throw it out. And I want to make sure that I do right by people who have done right by me, you know, pay it forward, that kind of thing. So it's difficult, though, to find, you know, who these things go to. It seems like you are a perfect person, if I'm a genealogist, to want to get things to other collectors.
Right. Of course, genealogists have the skills to do the research and maybe track somebody down. But Just the Joy gives genealogists as well an opportunity to easily communicate with other genealogists. Every time a member joins the site, they let us know the surnames that they are specifically interested in. That gives us a database that we can use to automatically generate alerts based on the new items that are posted each day. And we thought in the beginning that there would be two types of memberships. There would be memberships for people who wanted to sell items, and then there would be memberships for people who wanted to find the items. But at the very first genealogy event that we went to, we learned that genealogists can't throw things away either anymore than antique dealers can. And so we made a single form of membership so that all members can post while they are trying to retrieve their own items. That's why we call it an exchange. And it's fun, it's exciting. Even if you're on the angel, we call it the angel side. If you're the one that posts the item, it's as exciting when you make a match nearly as if you discovered something for yourself.
Well, absolutely true. We're talking to Joy Shiver from Charlotte, North Carolina. She's the creator of JustAJoy.com, where you can match antique dealers with people who are looking for memorabilia for their own families for just $20 a year, which is insane, by the way, Joy. So thank you for your service, because that's what this is more than anything. And I think we need to clarify, because we talked about, you know, the eBay comparison at the beginning. There's really no bidding that goes on with this, is there?
That's right. And there's no commissions or buyer's premiums. Everything is done between the person who has the item and the person who wants it. We actually just are a place for people to post, and we've created the machinery to make it possible to find the right person. But no, we're different in eBay from eBay in that aspect as well. But the main thing is, with the surname field, we make it possible to get the correct results when you search.
Well, it's a great idea. I'm excited for you. I'm glad you're around, and I think you're doing great work for those of us who are trying to find out more about our ancestors, Joy. So thanks so much for your service.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And coming up next, he is our preservation authority, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, with information on how to get better audio when you're interviewing your grandma and your grandpa, and how to preserve it. It's on the way in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. Welcome back, Tom.
It's good to be here.
And, of course, you can always ask Tom questions by emailing him at asktom@tmcplace.com. And today we're going to talk about audio, Tom, because that is such a difficult thing to preserve in many ways. It's different than photographs. It's different than words. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, that's so true, Fish, because audio is so important. There was a test group done years ago. Each of the test groups had like about 100 people in it. They went through them, interviewed them, so they could try and get both groups as similar as possible. Then they went in and they both watched the movie. The movie was exactly the same. The only difference between the two is the audio mix, the background music was different. And when they interviewed the people afterwards, the first group, the response was that they loved it, they wanted to come back and see it again, it was a great movie. Then the other one where they made some audio changes to it, 40% of the people said they enjoyed the film, while the majority, 60%, didn't like the film and would not recommend it to anybody else.
And it was because of the sound.
Exactly. There was no difference otherwise. It was exactly the same. And we have talked about this before, that if you're sitting there listening to Grandma and Grandpa talking and you're interviewing them and the refrigerator's humming, your brain will totally make it go away. But then when you have it on tape or on disc or however you want to record it, it's going to drive you nuts because that's all you can hear.
Well, it's funny you say that because I was giving a talk at an event where much of the audience was sitting over by an ice maker. And there was a recording going on of the whole thing, and it was just so distracting when I looked back at it afterwards.
Oh, it is. It's really, really bad. And there's so many easy things you can do to get rid of that. The first thing I suggest people do is get a good set of headphones. You need to make sure whenever you're interviewing Grandma and Grandpa, you have a good set of headphones, because then you're listening to what is exactly getting recorded. So if you're sitting there going, oh, wait, hey, just a sec, what's that noise? We go find out. Maybe it was the air conditioner. Maybe it was a bad plug that was humming. It could have been a refrigerator. It could have been a cat.
And you don't notice that in a room in general, but when you have headphones on, you can pick those up.
Oh, yeah, because it emphasizes all those things where in a normal situation, you're not going to hear them because your brain's going to say, hey, focus on this. We have more people come into our store or call us on the phone and say, I've got some problems with Grandma's interview, or I've got this thing. And, you know, we always do video editing, but it's always the audio that's the hardest to fix. A lot of times it's the most expensive to fix, and it's the most irritating out of all of them.
You're absolutely right. And we deal with that in the radio industry as well. You have a bad component in there. Trying to fix audio is very difficult.
Oh, it is. It is. Because anytime you're doing stuff with photographs, like you mentioned, video, you can actually see it. You can freeze frame it and clean it in Photoshop or look at it and see what the problem is. With audio, you can't pause audio.
Right, and fix it frame by frame.
I'm going to get a little bit more into how you can take care of your camcorders and your audio things if you want to get better audio. Just remember, get a good set of headphones. No matter what you're shooting in an interview, plug your headphones in. If you don't want big muffs like most kids have, get the little kind that go in an iPod and just put them in your ears, and you'll get so much better quality audio.
Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. We're talking audio today, because this is such an important thing. You know, I think to some extent, Tom, I would almost rather have a really good audio recording of my great-grandparents or my grandparents, even than a movie, because the sound captures their personality. You can hear their stories much more cleanly if it's good. I'm fortunate to have a few recordings from the 1950s that are just stellar. And it makes such a difference to my family to be able to hear my father, my grandfather telling stories. In fact, grandpa from back in the 1890s.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that's one reason if you have the old reel-to-reel audio tapes laying around, don't discard them. Don't throw them out. Send them to us or get somebody that can transfer them to CD for you, because most of those have really good fidelity to them, and they're just incredible the way they sound. And even if they're starting to flake a little bit, we can do a thing that's called shake and bake, where we can actually bake the tapes, make them usable again.
Wow.
So keep those reel-to-reel tapes because they're really important. You know, and like I said earlier, audio is the most neglected aspect of family history preservation. Everybody says, oh, it's just audio. We can fix it in the mix. No.
It's really hard to do that.
Right. You, with your background in radio for so many years, you understand this.
Yeah, it's really tough. And I often will bring in somebody else from within the building and say, hey, take a look and see if you can figure it out. And inevitably, it's like, oh, you can hear the moan.
Right.
When they hear the buzz behind it or a hum or something's not quite right. And there's nothing more discouraging than losing something that important, especially because a lot of these old folks are not really anxious to talk to you about their stories.
Exactly. And it's tough to get that. Sometimes it's just somebody going around at a wedding interviewing people. And if you've got some hum that's in your camcorder or whatever, it's going to sound bad. So a lot of times what we have to do is take the bad part and reduce it as much as we can, and then take the good part and bring it up as much as we can. But if they cross, they're going to cross. There's nothing you can do about it.
So the best advice, of course, always try to make sure it's good while you're recording it and not trying to fix it later.
Right. And the only way you're going to know that is with a good set of headphones. That's more important, even I would say, even than a microphone. Get a good set of headphones so you can hear what's really going on. And like you said about the video and audio, we have people constantly with, they set Grandma and Grandpa up, and the audio is really, really bad, but the video is beautiful. It's even harder to get audio edited if it has to stay with the video because of the lip sync situation.
Right.
So we ask them, you know, which do you prefer? Say, if we take just the audio off and worry about just the audio and forget about the video, we have more parameters and things that we can edit to make it better. Is that okay? And 90% of the time, they say, that's fine. All I care about is the audio, just like you just said. So you got to be really, really careful. And again, 20 times, get a good set of headphones when you're recording.
And another thought, by the way, when you do get your reel-to-reel tapes digitized or your old cassette tapes, you want to make sure you don't ever throw those things away, because they actually may preserve and probably do preserve longer than some of these discs.
Oh, absolutely. And we've talked about this probably about a year ago when our first episodes. You know, if you go into the store and you see all these CDs and some of them are 10 cents a piece and some of them are 50 cents a piece, you're going to think, oh, I'm getting the 10 cent one. Well, the 10 cent ones might only last 3 months. We have more people come in with CDs and DVDs that have degraded because they used a poor quality die. That's why they cost less. That's why I only use Taiyo Yuden discs. They're the best discs out there. I've never had one come back.
And you've got more information on that on your website at tmcplace.com.
Exactly.
And of course, if you have a question for Tom, you can email him at any time, asktom@tmcplace.com, and you just might hear your question answered on the show. Thanks for joining us, Tom. We'll see you again next week.
Sounds good.
Thanks once again to Joy Shiver from JustAJoy.com and David Allen Lambert from the New England Historic Genealogical Society, where we talked about colonial wars and how you get the military records of your ancestors. Good stuff. If you missed it or you want to hear it again, catch the podcast, which is out on Mondays. You can find it at iTunes and iHeartRadio and, of course, at ExtremeGenes.com. Take care. We'll talk to you again next week. Have a great one. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.